KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Adams Point.
I'm from East Oakland.
I live in West Oakland.
Tenderloin.
The Mission.
I live in the Bayview.
Coming up, we'll tag along with a trans teen on a doctor's visit.
It was pretty humiliating because they probably hadn't really interacted with other trans people before or people who are getting this particular kind of surgery. So they were, you know, interested and curious, but kind of in the wrong ways. So it felt very much like I was sort of a spectacle.
And we learn about the lives surrounding a West Oakland recycling center through the lens of a local filmmaker.
The whole point of making the film wasn't to say, oh, the gentrifiers are bad, or oh, the poor people are addicts, or whatever. It was to have the conversation.
Stay tuned. Cross Currents is coming up. Debates around language and bathrooms for transgender individuals might make the headlines, but there's something else people need to navigate every day: healthcare. Even if doctors know what physical changes will happen when transgendered patients take specific hormones and medications, they may not have the needed skills for interacting with transgender patients. And what about kids? Medical care for transgender youth is a new field. In the U.S., recommendations have been out for less than 10 years. Many doctors don't know the terminology, the best practices, or how to make referrals to specialists. KLW reporter Christine Nguyen is also a pediatrician. She spent some time exploring how she and her colleagues are learning about the medical care of transgender kids. And a note to our listeners, the names of the mother and son in this story are pseudonyms used to maintain privacy and due to ongoing legal proceedings.
Hi, Nico.
Hi.
Katrina,
hi.
Nico.
Nice to meet you.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, thank you for inviting me into your home.
Nico just got home from school. Got home from work. I bike.
I'm meeting Nico and his mom, Katrina. Nico's 15. He's a transgender boy, which means he was labeled a girl at birth, but he identifies as a boy.
This is our sourdough bread. And we make it about once a week.
School's out for the summer here in Northern California. And Nico and Katrina are at home baking bread to go along with their dinner.
And it's pretty much yeast and flour and water that's just kind of like, that. I don't know if fermenting is the right word,
yes.
But you know. One thing that's cool about it is you can share it with other people. So like if someone else wants to start making sourdough, uh-huh. You can take some of it out and like put it in another jar and give it to someone else. So it kind of just keeps growing that way.
Nico wears a gray sweatshirt despite the warm day. He's got braces. Katrina is a small woman with a big voice. She says Nico came out to her when he was in eighth grade. Even before then, she had wondered about his gender identity. But she felt Nico needed to come to his own decisions.
I had thought since he was like 7 years old that he was a gay female. Totally gonna grow up to be, you know, tough lesbian woman, you know? And I was like, oh, cool, great. And it all just converged all at once for me. And suddenly a light bulb went off in my head and I thought, wait, I wonder if Nico is actually trans and not gay. But I didn't want to say anything to him because I didn't want to plant a seed or make him uncomfortable. Even all these years I had thought that he was gay, I never said a word.
Nico had identified as a boy for as long as he could remember.
Growing up, even from age 3 or 4, I always knew that I felt like a boy, and I almost just thought of myself that way. I was about 12 and a half when I realized that I was actually transgender, because it almost didn't sink in for a while that I even was like a girl.
One of the conversations he said was, you know, when I was little, I used to just think every night, oh, I'll probably wake up tomorrow and then be the boy.
Research shows that children form a gender identity as early as 2 or 3 years old. When kids start school around age 5 or 6, the gender differentiation becomes more of an issue if they don't conform to stereotypical male or female roles. But it's with the onset of puberty, which can be as young as 8 years old for girls or 10 for boys, that the disconnect causes severe distress. Nico remembers when his mom got him his first bra.
She came home one day in like the end of fourth grade and gave me like a running bra, and I like cried for 3 hours.
Nico wore homemade binders made of old sheets to squash down his breasts. He was traveling when he started his period and kept it a secret for 2 weeks.
Well, actually, I was on a trip with my dad. I didn't tell them at all. I just told my mom when I got home finally because I needed stuff, you know.
You didn't tell your dad?
No.
You just, how did you, I mean, if you're on a trip with your dad and your period starts,
just toilet paper. Yeah. Yeah, it was not good.
Puberty highlighted a conflict Nico had felt all his life. He was a boy. He assumed he was gay, but realized through testimonials on YouTube that he was trans. Around that same time, Nico was having a lot of symptoms that brought him to the doctor's office. And every physical exam was a reminder of how his body was developing in ways he didn't want it to.
It always felt very uncomfortable, but I didn't know how to express that, and I was never really able to talk about it with other people. I didn't really know how to.
The whole medical system made him feel misunderstood. Nico remembers a technician he met while getting an ultrasound to check for appendicitis.
My mom was explaining to the person who was doing the ultrasound, his pronouns are he and him, even though it says on your sheet, female, and this name, like, that's not the name you should use. And the lady was like, okay, maybe I'll try. I mean, yeah, there wasn't much I could do in that situation.
All right, so we're gonna go into room 20. Okay, so I'm gonna need you to be a little pretty relaxed, okay? Can I see this arm?
Many studies show that transgender kids avoid basic medical care because of past rejection or discrimination by medical professionals and a system that presumes traditional gender norms.
Everything looks pretty good, and the doctor, she'll be right with you, okay?
Hi, how are you? I'm Dr. Nguyen. Nice to meet you.
Hi.
That's both unsurprising and unsettling. You see, I'm a pediatrician, and the first time I met transgender kids in the office, it was awkward. I wasn't even sure what trans meant. I tripped on pronouns. I tried to work around it by saying the patient's name or you. I'll even admit I was skeptical of these kids. Was this just a phase? Trans kids who've been surveyed say when they seek healthcare, some of the most frustrating barriers are health workers equating gender identity with sexual orientation, silence that comes across as disapproval, and the inconsistent use of pronouns. When I ask colleagues for advice, I'd be told someone else might know something. But finding that person wasn't easy. Many U.S. medical schools still don't talk about transgender health. They aren't required to. I asked my friend Matthew Riley, another doctor, his training experience.
Did you receive any formal education about transgender health in your preclinical years in medical school?
Zero. No, none at all I can remember.
A 2011 study showed that a third of U.S. medical schools had 0 hours of LGBT education during clinical training. The lack of training may be an even bigger problem for pediatricians and family doctors. Kids are more likely to report they are transgender or questioning their gender than adults. Katrina and Nico remember an office visit with a surgeon to discuss top surgery to remove breast tissue. The doctor's entire team entered the room.
A trans person doesn't even like to look at their body themselves when they're alone in the mirror, let alone they're going to have to show the doctor, let alone three other people on the team. Plus, they brought in a nurse, and then they brought in a scribe to be taking notes on the computer.
And the scribe was using my wrong name and wrong pronouns.
There's suddenly five people in the room, and he has a gown on, and instead of using the term chest, which is what you use with a boy, because Nico's a boy, the doctor was using the word breast, and then, you know, opening the gown and talking about the breast and touching the breast.
It was pretty humiliating because it sort of felt like they were looking at me sort of as this, like, new thing that probably hadn't really interacted with other trans people before or people who are getting this particular kind of surgery. So they were, you know, interested and curious, but kind of in the wrong ways. And so it felt very much like I was sort of a spectacle.
Nico's story reminded me of a patient of mine, a transgender girl. It took months before she came out to me. We were glad to finally acknowledge the elephant in the room. But when it came time to examine her, I didn't want to call attention to the parts of her body that still looked like a boy. So I avoided that part of the exam. To be fair, medical schools have a lot to cover and have to prioritize their curriculum. And less than 1% of people in the United States identify as transgender. Despite that, most doctors, and not just pediatricians like me, want to know more. A 2017 study showed that 100% of internal medicine residents, which are doctors specializing in adults, thought they needed to know about transgender medical issues. Less than half had received any education. But things are starting to change. UC San Francisco's medical school has developed a comprehensive program to train new residents and nurse practitioners. At Stanford, medical students can take electives in gender clinics.
My name is Mitch Gavelber. I do pediatrics and adolescent medicine.
Dr. Gavelber works at Santa Clara Valley Medical Center in San Jose. As the county hospital, a majority of Valley Medical's patients are in Medicare, Managed Care, or Medi-Cal, California's Medicaid program serving low-income residents. For Dr. Gavelber, meeting several transgender teens around 2013 made him realize there was a gap in his medical expertise.
There was a young person in the juvenile hall system that wanted to start transition. That kid needed a primary care doctor to follow her after she left. And so I was fairly uncomfortable with that idea because I really didn't know what to do or how to do that care. I was willing, but not very much able. And it just seemed like something that I should be able to help with and not necessarily just throw up my arms and admit that I didn't know anything.
There are now 40 comprehensive child and adolescent gender clinics in the U.S. It's a new field. The first one was established in 2007. But access to these clinics isn't always easy. There are long wait lists. They are only in certain geographic areas. There are insurance exclusions, and sometimes the general pediatrician is the gatekeeper to more specialized treatment. So eventually, Dr. Gavelber started an ad hoc gender clinic in San Jose with guidance from his patients.
Young people, I think many transgender folks, share the story of having to educate their doctors. One held me to a very high bar and would, I think, almost tease me about my limited knowledge. And then the other was really helpful about she was incredible about saying, you can do this. We're going to do this together. And so she kind of guided me as well through the process. And then I started seeing a couple other, and then a couple other, and a couple more. And then I started going to conferences.
All right, well, let's get started. We're really excited about this workshop today. I'm Magalie Fossiotto. I'm Assistant Dean in the Office of Faculty.
Conferences, lectures, workshops, voluntary additional trainings are where medical professionals have to seek out best practices. Dr. Tandy A., a pediatric endocrinologist at Stanford University Medical School, conducts seminars about transgender medicine. I went to one along with about 30 university medical school faculty, doctors, psychologists, and nurses who, like me, don't specialize in gender issues. As usual, we squeeze in extra learning during lunch, and that's why you hear all those sandwich wrappers.
Thank you for coming and spending your lunch hour, or about 90 minutes, learning about a very important topic to me. I see from the list that there's a lot of different subspecialties who are here, so this really is meant to be not just a pediatric issue, but for everybody in medicine, because I know when I was training, we had no formal education in this. And
as a pediatrician, I'm a child advocate. And the statistics about the rates of depression, anxiety, drug and alcohol abuse, and suicide among transgender kids really got my attention.
In fact, 43% of these kids have ideation or have attempted. And that was the single reason why I actually got involved.
About half of transgender kids have suicidal thoughts, and about a third actually try to commit suicide. Many others try to physically injure themselves.
Thank you for the talk. It's very eye-opening and...
It's not just about medications or surgeries. There are lots of basic, practical logistics. Many medical forms require that you check male or female. What if the answer is neither? What if one parent supports the child's transgender identity and the other parent doesn't? How do you do a physical exam on a kid who is uncomfortable with how their body is developing?
I think a kid the other day was sharing their experience of telling a doctor and the doctor replying, but you're such a beautiful, I think in this case it was girl, why would you want to do that?
The American Academy of Pediatrics and other medical societies endorse the gender-affirmative model of care, which means supporting a child to be the gender they feel is most authentic. But that position does have its skeptics.
Parents, doctors, people struggle with when you make physical changes to bodies that are healthy and appear normal. It becomes challenging.
For transgender kids, the developmental, psychological, and medical issues are more complex than for adults. Kids, especially younger kids, may change their minds. So taking puberty blockers can buy time to decide if their gender identity is persistent. But the next step, taking cross-sex hormones or having surgery, can be ethically difficult. Dr. Gavelba recalls what another doctor asked him.
You know, the question was raised is, if I'm going to remove normal tissue from a normal, healthy person, that's pretty uncomfortable.
Some treatments are reversible, others are not, and there are side effects we may not even know about yet. In 2015, the National Institutes of Health started a 5-year study to look at the long-term outcomes of medical treatment for transgender youth. UCSF is one of 4 national study sites. For Dr. Gavelber and other pediatricians, the information from this study will give systematic national data. Right now, much is anecdotal.
So we'll give it a couple minutes and then we'll slice it and put some butter on it.
If you're hungry, I can. You can have some salad now,
oh
too.
My goodness.
There we go.
This is delicious. I'll put yours in.
Over homemade sourdough bread, I shared with Nico my initial awkwardness with trans kids. What was his advice?
It's true. If you haven't had a certain experience, how are you supposed to know? And I think the best thing to do is listen and just treat them like any other human being, really, because that's all they are.
I leave through a hallway filled with Nico's childhood artwork and photos, and I wonder if a picture of a little kid in overalls is Nico.
That is his brother.
Nice. Yeah.
See, this is a picture in my entryway here of Mahu, which is someone in Native Hawaiian culture who encompasses both male and female. And I saw this even before Nico came out as trans.
And I put that right at the entryway because I feel like it sets the tone for Absolutely. What I want my home to feel like.
Research shows education can change doctors' attitudes towards gender nonconforming kids and their willingness to take care of them. Looking at the picture of Mahu, I got that. Every patient has subtle differences. Their bodies have not read the old textbooks, and medicine is a constantly evolving field. If we follow the lead of our young patients, we may yet change our traditional concepts of gender. In San Jose, I'm Christine Nguyen for Cross Currents.
Christine Nguyen is a pediatrician in Santa Clara County and a recent graduate of KALW's Audio Academy training program. You can find out more about medical care of transgender youth. Go to KALW.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Henat Baba. September is National Recovery Month. It's a time to increase the understanding of mental and substance use disorders and celebrate people who overcame them. In recognition of people struggling with addiction, the East Bay organization Options Recovery Services is sponsoring a screening of a documentary this Sunday. The movie's called Dogtown Redemption. Filmmaker Amir Sultani and his team spent 7 years following the lives of 3 people who make a living recycling bottles and cans in West Oakland. The film brings up questions about how gentrification affects some of Oakland's poorest residents. The movie screened on PBS's Independent Lens in 2016, and that's when Amir sat down with KALW's Jen Chien to talk about it.
Tell me about the genesis of this film.
I moved to West Oakland around 9 years ago,
and I was staying in my brother's house, which was in an area of West Oakland called Magnolia Row. And every morning, night, whenever we would put the trash out, people would come and go through the trash. There were times when you would put out the trash and one, two, three, you know, people just kept on coming and going through the same trash can. And it just struck me at the depth of the poverty. You know, there was this, they were maybe 2-3 meters away from me, but we were really worlds apart. So eventually there was one guy coming down the street who was half paralyzed. His name was Jefferson. He was a longshoreman, so he'd worked in the port of Oakland. And he was taking the trash out with one hand. So I went down to help him, and we started a conversation. I'm like, Jefferson, what are you doing? He's like, well, I pick up these bottles and cans, and I take them to Alliance Metals down the street. So I followed him. We went to Alliance Metals. At first glance, it was like a giant garbage can. It's a recycling center. So all the trash is coming there. And at the same time, it was like this pilgrimage site for poor people. So all the shopping carts that we see in different places, they were all heading there. And so you go in, and on the one hand, it's people who are very, you know, you're just amazed that they're surviving because they have mental health, you know, all kinds of issues from, you know, poverty comes in so many shapes and forms.
And from so many directions.
And from exactly so many directions. And you just, every direction that you looked, it was bewildering. And yet it was also so stylish. You know, everybody was recycling in their own way with their own, you know, with their own cart, their own style.
Well, it's entrepreneurship.
It's total entrepreneurship.
Right. No, we don't normally talk about it like that.
Exactly, but. Jen. It was like the entrepreneurship of the underclass. It's like creating something out of nothing.
Let's listen to a clip from the film.
We are one of the busiest recycling centers in the state of California. I am the redeemer. I redeem the money to the person who walks in.
Where else but America can you make $100 a day picking trash up off the streets? You know, it's like the old days when my great-grandfather came to this country, they told him, there's money in the streets, there's gold to be made. And although it's not literally true, figuratively it is. I mean, you can get up, be dead broke, no education, no skills, get yourself a shopping cart, walk around the streets, and make $100.
Initially, I thought, okay, we'll just tell the story. We'll just show people the recycling center. But their life journeys were as interesting as the story of the recycling center.
And that's ultimately what the film has become, is really letting us get to know these people that are kind of invisible to mainstream society. But we really dive in and get to know their histories and their hopes and dreams and their families even.
On the one hand, it was the stories of the people. On another level, it was the story of the recycling center. And on a third level, it was the story of West Oakland.
What did you learn over the course of making this film about this really thorny issue of gentrification and the kind of different sides?
The whole point of making the film wasn't to say, oh, the gentrifiers are bad, or oh, the poor people are addicts, or whatever. It was to have the conversation and to approach each other from a point of empathy. Because, in fact, there is so much talent, so much generosity, so much kindness also in our communities. And that's what we wanted to summon.
I'm speaking with documentary filmmaker Amir Sultani. I wanted to play another clip. This is Landon, who, when we first meet, is addicted to crack and living on the street. With the help of a program his cousin runs, he eventually becomes a preacher, and then he begins to reach back out to people that he was living with while he was out on the street. Here's what he has to say.
I don't miss being on the streets, people making you get up and move. You have to tear it down and move on to another place. I don't miss that, no. But what I do miss is people. The love that we did share for one another in looking out for one another. You find it greater in that society than you do in this society. Because I can walk down the street right now, and if I don't say hello to nobody, nobody will say hello to me.
So I think that this movie does a wonderful job of showing the depth of the humanity of people that often get passed over, you know, as we spoke about, invisible. And it's kind of a sad commentary that we need to rehumanize people who are human. Was that something that you explicitly thought about from the beginning of making the film?
Dogtown Redemption is about people who are defying Darwin. You know, by any measure, they should be dead. By any measure. And yet they survive, you know? And in a way, they embody so much of what we would we as the members of the middle class or upper class, whatever, fear, right? What happens when you lose your home? What happens when you lose your family? What happens, what happens, what happens? That's what happens. And still, there's humanity. There is humanity in that recycling center. But it's also, you know, you just see the, I mean, the question for me, the economic question is, what are we as a society offering the poor? What are the ways of reintegrating the poor into the economy so that they can afford housing, so they can afford these things? And when you actually see how capable people are, not people who are super functional, but just barely functional.
And still able to get up and work every day. That struck me that this is a job.
People exactly.
Work from morning till evening and do things like pull loads of 800 pounds just right. With their own bodies.
And as manual labor, all of these kinds of work shift out of America, we're going to have a third world in America. Everything is being robots taking over. The middle class, you know, these aren't just personal stories. There's a sort of structural thing that's taking place.
That was filmmaker Amir Sultani talking about his documentary Dogtown Redemption with KELW's Jen Chien. Alliance Metals, the recycling center in that piece, has since closed, but the film is screening this Sunday, September 30th at the New Parkway Theater in Oakland. You can find that story and more at our website, kalw.org. That's also where you can subscribe to our podcast and to our weekly newsletter. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.